This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This is the final part in our comedy and mental health mini-series. I'm so delighted to have had 3 whole weeks to delve into this topic and to have met so many comedians whilst recording here at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. The last person for this mini-series is Ashley Story. She's a stand-up comic from Glasgow, and she also makes viral videos and hosts a radio show with the BBC. A lot of things have happened to her that I think the best way she described it was a pretty statistically impossible that all of those things happened at once, and yet they did. But she's plowed what she's learned about her mental health and that of other people around her into creating a career in comedy with mental health conversations and reducing stigma very much at its core. So she's a really wonderful guest to finish up this mini-series with, and yeah, just a really funny, cool person to interview.
I'd love to watch her show.
She's a lot of fun. And yeah. So we already gave the stats in the first episode, but we do have one article we found recently, which is a bit of good news, which we like sharing a bit of good news on the podcast. This is from Aberdeen Inspired, and the article title is Aberdeen International Comedy Festival Teams Up with Mental Health Aberdeen. I'll just read a few extracts from that. They say laughter is the best medicine, and audiences at the upcoming Aberdeen International Festival can have a good laugh and support a local charity at the same time. Laughter has a multitude of benefits when it comes to mental health, including making people happier and more optimistic, improving self-esteem, bringing people together, and sharing positive experiences. Adrian Watson, chief executive of Aberdeen Inspired, said, "The therapeutic benefits of laughter to mental health are well documented, and alongside the fundraising element to this partnership, we hope that it can also help reach out to an audience of people who may find it difficult to talk about their mental health. Comedy is increasingly being used to help combat mental illness. Laughter can boost your mood by releasing endorphins and reducing the stress hormones cortisol and epinephrine in our brains. Mental health is also a topic on the agenda for a number of comedians at the festival, including Ashley Story, who focuses on mental health and the way she uses humour to overcome her pain." So I thought that was a really positive thing to mention there. Obviously, this episode was recorded at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, but it's great to see that other festivals are taking on this element of, okay, how can we support mental health? How can we use the vehicle of comedy to start conversations and reduce stigma? And if you wanted to catch that and find yourself in Aberdeen, that runs from the 3rd of October until the 13th. And Ashley, today's guest, will be performing at it. Is there anything you wanted to mention from that, Danielle?
Well, I just thought that was great. It's so recent, you know, that it's right now. You know, I just think it's brilliant. I mean, big up Scotland.
Yeah.
I mean, who knew?
It's really great. And I think one thing listeners will notice paralleled in this interview is that there are certain areas of Scotland which are just known to have increased levels of stigma towards mental health, are known to have increased drug dependency, which a lot of that will relate back to mental health issues like addiction, or as a coping or escape mechanism from other mental illnesses. So it's really great to see that in places where historically mental health hasn't been talked about, it's now going so far the other way. And charities relating to this are being brought right into the heart of comedy festivals. And that link that we've been discussing in these episodes is really being utilised.
Yeah, I thought that was great. You're absolutely right. You know, we know historically that there are some quite high levels of mental illness. And as you said, you know, drug misuse and alcohol misuse, like there are in many areas of the UK, but absolutely brilliant. Brilliant that Scotland are really taking this on and using it, plugging it, if you like, through, you know, comedy. It's just brilliant to hear. I'm well impressed.
Yeah, it's really positive to hear. And it's particularly relevant when out of the countries in the UK, Scotland is the one with the highest number of suicides, according to the BBC. Northern Ireland is the highest if you look at suicides per number of people in the population. So they have the highest concentration, but Scotland has the highest overall number.
So it's great that they're addressing it. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, so we wanted to finish on a nice positive note when it came to these intros. And I think, listeners, you'll really enjoy this interview. Ashley is one of these naturally funny people, which I'm quite envious of. But
you're naturally funny, Bob. You're naturally funny. Don't put yourself down.
Am I? No, it's... I don't know. Maybe it's work for everyone to be funny. I feel like I work harder for the laugh. But we will get into that interview with Ashley to round up our comedy and mental health series in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Ashley Story, and I'm a stand-up comedian from Glasgow. And my experience with mental health has been my whole life. My family have terrible mental health. My cousin lived with me growing up because both of his parents had committed suicide. My daddy had tried to kill himself before I was born. He said now he has autism. He hadn't been diagnosed with autism at the time, but he says now that he thinks he did it for attention because he was one of seven brothers and his dad just didn't give him anything, and his mum had died under suspicious circumstances. Oh, I don't know how. I don't know. Am I allowed to talk about murder? Okay.
Of course, yeah.
She was...
I don't know why I said of course. No, you meant. We talk about murder all the time.
Because I'm quite flippant. I think when you've lived with all these dark things from the very beginning of your life, it's so normal that you say these things and then you look at, like, muggles go, oh, no. But that's what it feels like. Yeah, I feel like a wizard of sadness. But my dad's mother, she died at like 47. She'd had seven sons, and her husband, my grandfather, was a career criminal. And he had a mistress who was much his junior, and he'd moved into a big new mansion. And the next day, she just died. His wife just died in her sleep, and everybody just accepted that. Years later, and I talked about this 2 years ago at the Fringe, I found a little book. As an adult woman, I found a little tiny book. Now, I never met this woman. I never met my grandmother. She died before I was born. My dad was like 12. Mm-hmm. I found this little tiny book, and it was my granddad's like crime log where he wrote all of his ins and outs. So wow. All of the money he spent, all of the money he got back, all of the money he lent, all of the cars he stole, the number plates he changed them to. And within that book, there was a payment to a doctor for £30,000. That he never got back, which I thought was very strange. And I said to my dad, oh, who's this doctor? And he said, oh, that was my mum's doctor. That was the doctor who declared her dead. And months before she died mysteriously in her sleep, he had paid this doctor 30 grand. And he moved in his mistress into the house the next day. And they all just carried on as if she hadn't existed.
Wow.
She was an alcoholic. My daddy then became very... I mean, he was... He was a wee autistic boy who didn't know how to communicate, and he was the second youngest of seven criminal brothers, and he didn't know how to get attention, and I know that he tried to kill himself. Because I've spoke to him about it, and he said, I just wanted my dad to come visit me in hospital. Like, that was what he was thinking about, was if I tried to kill myself, my dad would come visit me in hospital, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. He didn't come visit him. So mental health has always been something that I've been aware of, and then... When we left that life, my mother, my father and I, we all moved away from the criminal family and the bar that they ran and all of them. And my dad got seen by a GP who was amazing. And I had suggested, because I had been studying psychology at school and I had been given the Baron Cohen test, which is Sacha Baron Cohen's brother invented the test for Asperger's.
Oh, right.
And yeah, it's a list of questions. Oh. And he's the leading expert on Asperger's syndrome. And I read these questions to my dad, and it was like, do you struggle to answer a phone? Do you have an aversion to certain fabrics and things like that? And my dad was like, yes, yes. And he tested so high on this scale, and I was like, I think you have Asperger's. Mm-hmm. And my dad was like, I don't have Asperger's. I remember it so well because he thought he was making such a witty joke. And he went to a GP, and the GP, who was amazing, was like, no, you do. you have some form of autism, and that explains everything, because he'd been so angry, but he was so aware of his anger being logically flawed. So he got sent to like anger management group therapy before that, and he didn't fit in with the other people because they were just angry. And he was like, he couldn't explain why he was angry, and that made him angrier. And the autism kind of explained that. And he got seen by a leading expert in autism, and she very much changed his whole life, because he was like a volcano, like he could explode at any moment. If you touched the wrong thing or you said the wrong thing, he could explode, and then he didn't know why, and he just thought he was a bad person. And then he had this diagnosis, and it explained, and it made his life so much easier. It made his life easier, and he stopped being so very angry all the time, and knew when to take himself away from a situation because it was triggering him, or things like that. So yeah, pretty mental family.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Sometimes I hear things like that and I just think, you might be more mad if you'd come out neurotypical and normal from all of that.
How dare you, that's so inappropriate. No, you're right. I think it's important to laugh and joke about things. My mum's mum, she was also murdered. My other grandmother was murdered. She was pushed in the River Clyde by her very abusive boyfriend.
Wow.
And she got found by Catholic monks, which was unfortunate because she was very, very, very anti-Catholic. Hardcore proddy. But we joke about it a lot and it makes people so uncomfortable, but it's very much our coping mechanism. I don't think I would be a comedian had I had a happy childhood with a lot of like stability and normality. I think I'd probably be something really boring.
Particularly with mental illness, it seems to be a like general unofficial symptom that it can give you this kind of third party perspective,
yeah,
that I think lends itself quite well to comedy. That if you can see, oh, it's not just me trying to be funny,
mm-hmm,
everyone's telling stories and trying to make them funnier or more entertaining or more informative every time they tell them,
yeah,
and so you're making a career out of this kind of structured way in which people try and get along,
I guess. So yeah,
and sometimes you have to, I think, go through something to see that from a distance.
I do think that the best comedians are people who have that perspective because they've been through the worst, so that maybe they can see the best in the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Like Billy Connolly, he had a harrowing childhood, but he sees the best in the darkest of stories, and that's what makes him a great comedian. And I think that the greatest comedians have that. It's easy for us to all to play top trumps the sadness of who's had the saddest life. But if you deal with that bad thing that happened to you, be it small or big, still bad to you, then if you deal with it comedically, then you're probably wired the right way to be a stand-up comedian, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then there's people who don't, and there's people who come in to see my shows who are just like, you shouldn't laugh at that. I'm like, but it's mine, it's my sadness. I'm not laughing at other people's sadness, I never would. It's my sadness. You can't tell me how to process that. I mean, that was Daniel Sloss. I saw him doing comedy about his sister who had passed away, who was severely disabled.
Yeah, I remember that. That's on Netflix if people want to watch it.
It is, and I went, but don't watch it, he's got enough attention. And a woman in the front row, I saw him workshop that material at the stand, and a woman in the front row was like, no, and she just kept saying no under her breath because she didn't think it was appropriate for him to be laughing about this. And it was the first time I'd heard it verbalised so eloquently when he said, it's mine, you're not allowed to be offended on my behalf.
Mm-hmm.
It's my sadness, you can't, she's my sister, she's not your sister, you don't get to be offended on her behalf or my behalf, it's my family. And I thought, that's the way to look at it, that's the right way to look at it, because it's easy for us all to jump on being offended on somebody else's behalf, but you don't know if they want you to. So yeah,
absolutely. And I think the flip side of that is it can be quite dangerous, because then there's a pressure to keep somebody in a restrictive narrative. So if you talked about mental illness and everyone's response to that was sadness, then you kind of have to stay sad in order to conform to their expectations, Whereas if you can turn it around and find the humour in it, you can find a way to grow out of that.
I completely and utterly agree. It was said in a very clever way that's taken me a wee minute just to fathom. I think it's what makes us human. Mm. And not everything's for everybody. And not everybody gets it, and that's fine. And there should be no shame in that either. The lady who said no, who didn't like it, should be ashamed. But it's just, you can't try and censor other people's lived experience.
Yeah.
Because it makes you uncomfortable.
Exactly. And that was a genuine response for that woman.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean there's not opportunity for her to take away and grow from that as well.
Yeah, that's my big major issue with, especially when it comes to consent and abuse and things like that, is people are so uncomfortable about talking about it if you've not lived it, because you're kind of forced to think about it. My friend Matthew McVarish, he walked across all of Europe to, like, literally every country in Europe. He went to, on his feet, walked for 2 years nearly to change child abuse laws in different countries to get it unified across Europe, the age of consent and how long after you've been abused as a child you're allowed to bring prosecution against your abuser, because most people who are abused don't come forward until they're in their adult years because they can't process what's happened to them. He found that people who hadn't lived it didn't want to talk about it because it made them uncomfortable. But if you create that environment, then you create an environment where it's hard for adults or children to say, this has happened to me, because not because they're ashamed, but just because they don't want to make other people feel bad or sad. But it is happening, and you do have to say it out loud. I find it amazing, like, my friends who have been abused who come forward and say, this has happened to me. I don't care how it makes you feel, because I need to say it. Because it's a legal issue, and also I need to talk about it. I can't hide it any longer, because a big part of child abuse is hiding it. My mother was abused by her uncle, and she took him to court when I was in primary three, primary four of school, and it was something that I had to not talk about at school. And that was really weird, because it was something that we all talked about at home so much, but I couldn't mention it at school because it would rightfully upset the other children.
Yeah.
But I think that people who make that vocally say, this happened, and know that there's going to be five people going, oh, I don't want to even think about it, I think that's very brave.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's so important to respond appropriately, particularly when it comes to abuse, because of how brave that is and because of what progress it is. And I've been in positions in my own personal life where I've been the first person someone's told they've been raped to, or they've been sexually assaulted. They've told me first, and they may have only used those terms the first time when speaking to me. And that takes so much courage, because it's always followed by tears, because it's such a breakthrough to identify and name something that you've been hiding from. And in a similar but different way, I think there's a real parallel there with mental health. For so many people, a big part of that experience of mental illness is coming to terms with it, is the period of hiding it and explaining away the symptoms as they get bigger and bigger, until you're confronted with them in a way where you have to acknowledge it and get help.
I talk about in my show this year about that I'm doing at the Edinburgh Festival, I talk about icky consent situation I was in. And I don't like to use the term rape, because it was, it's one of those, I don't want to say grey area because it seems to negate it, but I went to a man's house and I got into bed with him, and then I changed my mind, and he did not respect that changing of the mind. So then I just lay and I accepted that this was happening to me, and because it felt safer than fighting, because fighting felt very dangerous. And I didn't tell anybody, but I would tell weird variations of the story on stage. Like, he made, his bed made a weird noise, and I would talk about that weird bed noise on stage, and I'd make people laugh with just the story about this man whose bed made a weird noise, or this man who made a funny noise when he had sex, and I would make this funny noise and people would laugh, and I would do it over and over and over again. And I didn't tell anybody until last year at the Fringe, when I was talking about consent and I was talking about the Me Too movement, and I was talking about Harvey Weinstein, and I was saying, you know, just punch them or something. I was being very flippant about it, and I thought, I didn't. I'm standing on stage saying, oh, you should have just punched him in the penis. And I was sitting in a cafe with my friend, and I remember the first time I hadn't told my mum, I hadn't told anybody, but I kept saying it on stage. And I said to my friend, he said something, and I was like, oh, well, I can't go out with this man because I'm not over the mild sexual assault. That was the word I used, a mild sexual assault. And he laughed and thought I was doing a bit. And then I just burst into tears. And I think he was horrified because he was just like, what's happening? Ashley, is this a bit? And I was like, no. And I told him what had happened. And it didn't feel like a weight off my shoulders because for 5 years, I had literally became a stand-up comedian the next day after the assault had happened. I decided, well, I'm going to be a comedian now.
Wow.
Been telling audiences that this had happened just in different ways. So it didn't feel hugely burdensome because I had really worked through it on stage. But to be able to...
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Yeah. You were finding ways to kind of process it and look at it from different angles through your work.
Very much so. But finally being able to say to my friend, this had happened, and he was shook. And then I spoke to my mum about it, and she was like, I kind of knew. I knew that something had happened.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell my dad because he would try and kill him. I firmly believe that my dad would just be like, nope, going back to my old gangster ways, goodbye family. But I had told audiences, and now I speak about it on stage, and it feels fine now. It's the more you speak about it on stage, the more you meet people who are like, oh, the exact same thing happened to me.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, I'm not a freak, I'm not a weirdo. And you know it is, you know in your heart of hearts that the same thing has happened to a million other people. And it's just one of the things, I just, you work through it, doesn't define you.
Yeah. But I think what you've highlighted there is why it's so vital we talk about any seemingly taboo topic, because it creates the outlet for more people to do that.
Yeah.
You know, that maybe you would have talked about it sooner had conversations around like the Me Too movement been happening more around you sooner.
Oh, 100%.
You know, maybe there would have been an in for you to bring it up.
Yeah.
Because it can feel like you're just dropping a bomb if you're just like, oh, so here's something I want to tell you guys about, as opposed to it coming up. And it's the same with mental illness. If it's just never talked about in certain situations, and this often happens in families, so luckily not by the sounds of it yours, it creates this wall that it's just sets a precedent of it not being something we talk about. So of course you're going to start thinking you're wrong for experiencing certain things where it's like, no, it's taboo, we don't talk about that.
Mm-hmm. I think coming from a very working class family, it's kind of helped that.
Mm.
Because I don't know, I went to private school, and a lot of the very upper class girls that I know find it very hard to talk about mental health, and very hard to talk about, like, I have a friend whose dad killed himself and they just don't talk about it. And it worries me endlessly that they just don't talk about it. They never discuss it. They never... It's a dirty thing that they don't ever want to talk about, and it's the shame of the family. Whereas my relatives killed themselves, and you'd walk to the bus stop being 3-year-old and somebody'd be like, oh, how's Jim? Threw himself under a train. Like, it would be so blasé and open. And I think it's just that sort of very scummy working class Glaswegian thing where we just say anything out loud and don't really care.
Yeah, but I think it's also a way of coping within your means as well.
Yeah.
That I think for people with more money, it's more natural for them to be so solution orientated. Like, oh, you've got this thing. Okay, we won't talk about it. Here, go to this like private counselling service. There, you're allowed to talk about it.
Okay, yeah.
Because
I never thought about it like that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with, you know, with private counselling, you can get in incredibly quick. You can skip the NHS queue. And so I think it's easier to look at it more as, okay, there's a problem, let's quickly get that fixed. Whereas if you're from a family where you don't have maybe such easy fast track options,
mm-hmm.
and you've still got to pay the bills at the end of the day, it's not like you can miss doing that.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to work through it in other ways, and maybe that's talking about it more at home.
That makes so much sense. I just thought that rich people just didn't talk about stuff. That makes a lot. No, you've actually explained a phenomenon to me.
Well, I think even a lot of similar parallels to that when it comes to money and finances within families. Like, for example, I think there's this idea that people with more money talk about it less because they don't need to.
Yeah.
But I think in reality, they actually just go to financial advisors and they talk about it. So, like, if something's difficult to talk about, they find a thing they can pay for,
yeah,
where they can talk about it there. And then it doesn't matter if they want to sit opposite someone and be like, okay, so I'm earning really good money, but I want more. Like, how can we figure this out with my tax? Like, that might feel a bit icky to yeah. say in a family.
No, that makes sense. Well, there we go.
That's my theory on it anyway.
No, I think you've nailed it. I think that's what it is. I think wealthy people pay other people to hear their stuff so that their friends and family don't have to.
Yeah, and then they can all be kind of polite and pristine around everyone.
Whereas poor people don't have that option, so they just shout it in your face at a bus stop.
Yeah, which I like. That feels far more real to
me. I like it too. I think it's colourful and noisy, and it's who I am and part of the fabric of me. You've properly hit the nail on the head there. Well done, you.
Thank you.
What else do I talk about?
We solved it now.
Solved that problem.
So, do you mind sharing a little bit more of how your mental health journey unfolded?
Well, I have always been what's described as weird, but...
Oh, really? Me too.
It's cool. when you've got all of this stuff going on at home, it's easy for, I think, doctors to just look at you and say, well, this is just a reaction to your environment,
right,
as opposed to your brain. So... when I was very young and my mum was taking her uncle to court, I was very overwhelmed by it, and I phoned Childline, and then I started to talk, and then I hung up, and I was like, it's not my, no, because there's other children who have worse things happening to them, so I don't deserve this, and hung up the phone and thought I'd done something really bad, mm-hmm. and like didn't tell, I thought I broke the law, like I'd phoned 999 yeah. almost, and I thought, oh, I've done something really wrong here, because that's for children who are being abused, it's not for children whose parents are going through a lot, and I had to take on a lot of adult roles and behave because my mum and dad were going through so much, what with my mum taking her uncle to court and them leaving the family and losing their house. We were homeless for a little while, and it was very, I was also being sent to private school at the same time, which was very confusing, and I wasn't allowed to talk about any of it, so everything was all trapped inside. And I remember the doctor just saying, you know, this is just, you're going through a bad patch and you'll be fine. And then at 16, when the bad patch was over and we were more financially stable and my mum was working and my dad was still depressed and he wasn't getting out of his bed because he hadn't been diagnosed with the autism yet. And I went to my GP. I said I was really, really sad. I didn't want to leave the house and I felt very sad all the time. And he said, people like you are just like that. And that was his official diagnosis. So I took that to the bank for about 10 years mm-hmm. of people like me are just like this and it's fine. I would go through bouts of extreme depression, of not wanting to leave the house, of not wanting to speak to people. I'd feel incredibly anxious in social situations. I had little twitches that my mum would like shout at me for because she had a lot going on. And I was just... in general, what would be described as weird. But I was very good at keeping it all in little boxes mm-hmm. and dealing with it when I was on my own in my room and being okay for my parents' benefit or for my friends' benefit or for my school's benefit. I'd be okay, deal with it. And I've only since found out that I'm on the autistic spectrum, and that's called masking. Mm-hmm. And women are very good at it, is pretending to be okay and then getting home and then unloading there.
Right, because I think even now so much women are put in the position in society of peacemakers.
Yeah.
And so in order to do that effectively, you have to bury some of your feelings, because if you add to the situation, it'll escalate. So you push that down and then you try and make sure everyone else is okay and try and delicately agree with both sides of every argument.
Yeah.
And what happens is you don't work on the stuff going on for you.
Exactly. This went on for a very, very long time. Like... just having all these feelings and pushing it down and being okay and saying it's fine, I'm okay for my mother's benefit or for my dad's benefit or for my friends and I'm fine. And there's always something, that's the thing you learn, is there's never, the storm never truly passes. There's bright spots, but then another bad thing is going to come that means you have to go, I'm okay,
mm-hmm.
I'm being good, I'm pushing it down. it was my mum trying to make it in comedy, and my dad was very unsupportive, so I would have to go on tour with her and help with that. And I loved it, and it was great. And having a stand-up comedian mother is brilliant, but I'd have to go and work, and I would have to go and be good for her because she needed support, because other comedians had their wives or their husbands or things there that my dad couldn't provide for her. So I would be that thing for her. I would be her plus one to events and smile and greet. And inside I'd be like, oh no, I've said something terrible, even though it wasn't, but I would chew over it in my head. And that, was that weird? Did I say something weird? Did I look at that person weird? And worry. And then eventually I got a new GP. She's called Dr. Ali. I love her.
There's one thing I wanted to mention before we talk more about Dr. Ali. I'm glad that you mentioned there about the kind of twitches you had.
Yeah.
Because I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand when it comes to symptoms, that in most cases, I believe, when you're pushing stuff down and you're doing your best to hide it and deal with stuff on your own, it's still coming out in other ways.
Yeah.
You know, maybe your moods make less sense to people. But twitches is another example where it might be like, you know, picking at or biting your nails more, or you might be scratching, or you might be constantly like messing with your hair. There could be any number of like kind of anxiety symptoms where you're constantly moving because it's an outlet for that.
I do one hand clapping, which is more of like a stimulation thing where I'm feeling particularly autistic and I need to push it all into, it feels good, like I'm pushing it all into one bit of my body. It's very hard to explain, but it comes out my one hand clapping. And anxious wise, I tug at my face. Like I'll squeeze my nose and I'll tug at my lip. And I had a persistent eye twitch for about 2 years that I was told was just because I wasn't getting enough sleep. But I think now we know it wasn't. It just made me look so weird with my one hand clapping and my eye twitch and my lip tugging. But it was all of, like you're saying, all of the stuff being stuffed in had to come out somewhere, and it came out there. And it was a coping mechanism. I still hand clap all the time, and I see people staring at me, but it's, if there's a lot of stimulation, noise or shouting or drunk people at the fringe, especially if I'm trying to walk from one venue to the other and there's just gangs of people shouting, the little hand goes off on one and I'll just be like walking about doing my little one hand clap, and it feels good. I like it. I don't feel ashamed by it. So if you ever see me, don't be staring. Don't be staring at my castanets. But I like it. But I went to Dr. Ali.
Yep.
And I just burst into tears. And I thought I had super gonorrhea. That was another thing, is I'd convinced myself I had illnesses.
Right.
And I would go to the GP and they would always ask me if I was unemployed. And I wasn't unemployed. And that would annoy me because they thought I was trying to get benefits or something. And every time I'd go, I'd have like neck pain, probably from the twitching, or I would have like, I would just be worried that I had something and I didn't know what it was. And they would be very dismissive. And then I saw Dr. Riley, who's an amazing doctor, and I just started crying. And I said, I think I've got super gonorrhea because I've got an itchy eye, and I've got a headache. And I Googled it and Google said, I've got super gonorrhea. And she kind of just looked through all of my stuff and she was like, your daddy has autism. And I was like, yeah. She was like, have you been tested for it? And I was like, no, because when I did ask to be tested for it, they said that it was learned behaviour as opposed to me being atypical, and they couldn't really tell because I presented so normal. She was very patient. She did have anxiety, first of all, and she gave me beta blockers so that my heart wasn't pounding constantly. And that was like revolutionary. Was to be able to go out the house and not like sweat a bucket and feel like my heart was pounding out my chest. And then I went through the process of getting diagnosed. And even to this day, there's still like questioning of, in my own mind, I question because it's not severe. I'm on the autism spectrum, or am I just a product of my dad's upbringing?
Right. But I guess it could be all of them, you know.
But it's just something I think about because I'm always that person who thinks, well, but somebody has it worse.
And there's an interesting contrast there, isn't there, with you having what's often referred to as health anxiety and you thinking you're having all these conditions that you don't. And then on the flip side, also beating yourself up, saying, oh, but I people have it worse, and that somehow invalidates my experience.
Yeah. The actual health conditions I have are not severe enough, in my opinion, to be like properly treated. But then I'm constantly fabricating. Yep. I don't know why I said fabricating conditions in my head. I'm always worried about like Legionnaire's disease.
Right.
I think I watched too much Casualty growing up.
I don't think that's a good show for you.
No, it's not. But I used to like watch it religiously and The Bill. And then every episode I'd be like, oh my goodness, what if that happens to me? What if I get trapped in a lift when I'm pregnant?
Despite not being pregnant, you would still have that fear.
Yeah. I have irrational fears. Like, I don't fear the real things. Right. I get worried about the existential things or the really unlikely things. Because really unlikely things happen to my family. It's unlikely that both your grandmothers would be murdered, but it happened to me. So when I worry that that one man on the internet who's like, I'm going to kill you, and people are like, he's not going to kill you, but I'm like, but what if he does?
So it's kind of like all bets are off, anything's possible now.
Pretty much, yeah, that's how I feel. And people think it's really strange, but then I think about my life and how statistically unlikely all of the things that have happened to me are. So I just hope, I like cross my fingers that all my statistics happened in the first decade.
Yeah, and hopefully you'll now win the lottery without even entering it. That would be a nice one.
That would be good. I wish my brain would think that. Instead of the pregnant lift thing.
I'm a very optimistic person, which I find very helpful from a mental health point of view, but can sometimes complicate things when I'm like around friends that are struggling and my mind is like turning a good thing out of everything they say, and I have to like sit in the feelings, which isn't a naturally like comfortable thing for me to do. But I'm getting that.
No, I think it's kind of nice. I think it's nice to have somebody who's like, but you never know.
Yeah, I think it's partly a reaction to like, I'm very much the friend that's like, okay, that's interesting. How are we going to fix it? And so I think it's from that that I learned as I was growing up, okay, you can't fix everything for everyone.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a way you can kind of like look at it more positively with your brain, and then you don't need to fix it as much.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's my theory on it. I would love to be one of those friends that's like, okay, we're going to sit and we're going to eat ice cream for 13 hours and we're just going to have a cry, and that kind of is fine. And then an hour in, that'd be scary then. I'd be full of ice cream and even more sad.
You're a doer.
Yeah.
That's good. No, people need that. I think it's easy for us to just do bad things to ourselves and call it self-care.
Mm-hmm.
Like eating a pint of ice cream and watching Netflix for 12 hours and being like, but it makes me happy. But it's not really self-care. It's just self-indulgence.
Yeah, and then, that's a really good point, because it can be difficult to define self-care for that reason.
Yeah.
Because you're just like, oh, but they're just giving into all your temptations. It's like, no, you're doing it to reward yourself. When you're doing it because 13 hours of ice cream seems more interesting than anything else you want to do, then that's maybe not helping you.
Yeah, and I'm a 13 hours ice cream girl, so this is coming from not a judgmental place, but a lived place. And I think that it's sometimes hard for me to go, no, that is something that's making me feel nice for the present and right now, but I'm going to have a tummy ache tomorrow and it's not going to fix what's wrong in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's harder to do the good things, the things that are good for you, as opposed to the things that make you feel good.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the complication of it, isn't it? That it's a formula you've got to work out for yourself.
Yeah, without it being all-encompassing.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing, is I've got a tendency to fixate and to just become whatever it is I'm interested in that week. Like you said, finding that formula of still being you, but being the best version of you.
Yeah. And in terms of you figuring out yourself, what kind of diagnoses have you received over the years? Have those changed?
Originally depression, anxiety. I don't know if I have depression. I think that they're wrong.
Why? Because there's people with it worse?
No, because I think that the sadness and the not wanting to leave the houseness are more symptoms of the autistic spectrum disorder and the anxiety, as opposed to just being depressed. I think the depression is a symptom as opposed to a diagnosis. So, okay. Yeah, anxiety, autistic spectrum disorder, which was called Asperger's, but now is not, which is an annoying thing for an autistic person to repeatedly change the name of their diagnosis.
And so out of interest with that experience of struggling to leave the house, is it very much like what we'd stereotype as like typical anxiety, that you're worried about all these possible eventualities?
I'm worried about, it's not just the possible eventualities, it's the being out and people judging. I like people to judge me on my own terms, which is why comedy's great for me, because you're judging me, but I'm giving you exactly what you're allowed to judge. And I'm getting to say the bad things about myself before you can think them. Like, that's always, like Eminem at the end of 8 Mile, that's very important to me. Is I like to make fun of myself before anybody else gets the opportunity to do it. Whereas on the street, people are mean. And people are often mean to me on the street. Like, people will shout stuff out their window.
Really?
Yeah.
Like what?
I tried a new hat because I wanted to see if I looked good in a wide-brimmed hat. And a man shouted out his car that I was a fat Indiana Jones.
Wow, it's specific and...
It is. And any other day, I'm fine with it. But just on days when I feel bad, I don't need... I've already got enough voices in my head being like, boo, to have people in their cars shouting stuff.
Yeah, you didn't need to now start worrying about to what degree you look like Indiana Jones each day.
Yeah, pretty much. I get worried about what other people think, which is so weird because usually I don't, but on bad, bad anxiety days, that's my main concern for some reason is what other people think. And I think that stems from being picked on a lot when I was younger for being fat or for being weird looking or for having a big giant head. And then, like, I looked like, there was a girl on EastEnders called Sonia Jackson and she played the trumpet and I played trombone. Mm-hmm. So when I would walk about with my trombone, people would shout, "Sonia, where's your trumpet?" And that would make me very annoyed. So it's just little things like that pop into my head. And I just don't want to give them anything to laugh at unless it's on my terms. So at the worst days, which they're rare now, but on the worst days, that's what's going through my head is... I don't want to get picked on by adults in the street.
Wow, I mean, and I certainly can imagine that everyone can empathise with that. I don't think anybody is out here trying to get picked on.
Because I wasn't always very good at being aware of people's facial expressions and what they meant, and I kind of overcompensate by overly analysing people's facial expressions. For example, I was at work, I do a radio show on BBC Scotland, and my legs were really hot, so I put on my cycling shorts and a jumper. And I saw this woman who's quite senior in the BBC, and she gave me this look that was just, like, up and down and then sourpuss. And I was like, oh, no, I'm being disapproved of by a higher-up. And it felt like the most cripplingly bad thing in the world. But I was like, my legs are really hot. And it was just such a strange thing. But then even though I have all those thoughts and feelings, and even though I feel... like I want to conform and just go past without anybody noticing, there's another part of my brain which has my mother's voice, and I don't know why, but it's very much like, be authentically you and fuck what everybody else thinks. And then I put on what I want to wear and I do what I want with my face and my hair and I just do it anyway. And that's very much my coping mechanism for the past couple of years has been, irrespective of what the bad voices in my head say, I just fuck them.
Yeah, I love that. But it's a very apt way of counteracting it, isn't it? That you're taking more ownership over what you put out to the world. Because the alternative is you worry about what you are appearing like, you strip yourself down to the greyest, boringest version of you, and then people still react in a certain way and you just keep beating yourself up with other people's words. So at least if you go out and wear what you want, then it's like, oh well, I knew this might be a bit controversial, at least they noticed me. Like,
very,
you know,
much so.
There's power in that.
I think it's really helped me. The dungarees changed my life. Nobody was wearing dungarees. I started wearing dungarees. People laughed at me in the street. I used to love dungarees when I was little, and there was this boy who used to sing Farmer Ashley as a cow, E-I-E-I-O, and I didn't ever wear dungarees again. And then as an adult, I was like, I want to. And I just thought, oh, I can't. like you say, you can't just live your life stripping yourself to the bone because somebody might look at you funny. And yes, people's faces mean a lot more to me than they probably do to other people because I'm so overly analytical of looks for fear that I miss something. And but I can't be beige.
Yeah.
It'll kill me. It literally feels like I'm dying. So I can't, I just have to do it. And then
yeah, I get that. It's incredibly restrictive. But equally, you're tapping into a level of observancy of other people that they probably won't even have themselves.
Exactly. And I can't put that on them. I can't put people's initial face reaction to me on them because it's just they're just being human beings and they're just reacting how they're reacting. It's not their fault that I'm so scared that I'm going to miss a social cue, like taking in all of the social cues, mm-hmm. even the subtle ones that don't mean anything.
Exactly, they don't really. I experience that in a fairly mundane way in that I walk around quite quickly. I always have like 10 places to be, particularly when you're somewhere like the fringe mm-hmm. and there's all the tourists. So I'm like dodging around, speeding through the crowds. And of course, more people look at you because they hear you coming and they don't want to bump into you when you're moving a fast walk. And, you know, there are plenty of people that, like, I dodge around a corner and they're just like, oh, because they didn't expect me.
Yeah.
It's not like it's not a facial expression that actually relates to their brain. It's just a mm-hmm. reflex. It's not a, it's just a, oh, person, yeah. human, dodge, like.
Whereas my little over-analytical brain will be like, what did that mean? And I'll, like, chew over it for 12 hours in my bed. Just like, but what did that mean? Did that mean something? Which is why I'm terrible with relationships. Because my little cousin, she's 18 and she's from London. And she's like, oh, I'm vibing. And I'm like, but how do you know? She like, looked at me and he gave me vibes. And I'm like, but how?
But what are these vibes? What do they look like?
What's the number of them? What's the exact look? And she's like, I don't know. It's just vibes. And I'm so envious of her.
That's a lovely way to live.
She's vibes about.
It sounds almost like she's putting the opposite on people. She's just like, yes, all these people are thinking very much good things about me.
Oh, she'd be furious. No. Yeah, probably. No, she's vibing. Because then they all are like, oh, hi, Gabrielle. And she's like, oh, hi, I'm vibing. I don't get it.
Well, I guess it's kind of self-fulfilling, isn't it?
Maybe it is.
And I certainly think that.
I'll tell you something that bothers me, though, is when you see stuff like that happen, it very much bothers me that we live in a society now where people's first instinct is to film it as opposed to intervene.
Yeah.
I think that's super weird. And I think it's weird when you have somebody on a train or a bus shouting abuse. I've been on a bus when I was a teenager and there was a creepy man, and I'll never forget him. He looked like Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. He had the blonde hair and he kept staring at me. And he was like licking his lips and staring at me. And it was really frightening. And this wee Scottish woman stood up and she pointed at him and she went, do you know him? And mm-hmm. I was like, no. And she turned to me, she went, take your creepy eyes off that wee lassie, you dirty, dirty bastard. And he got off the train horrified, or the bus horrified. And
I love that.
It was like a proper, she was like, there you go, sorted, sat back down, that's that, done and dusted. And I've done the same thing, where there's been like a drunk guy shouting racial abuse on the train, and I've been like, shut your pie hole.
Yeah.
Get off the train, I'll phone the police, I'm not frightened of you. And other people, men, grown men, have sat there, and grown women, when I've been like a teenager and quite visually young looking, have sat there and just not said anything because it's not worth their bother, or have been secretly filming it. And I've thought,
it's crazy to me.
But that's so weird.
One of the things I call it is bullshit British politeness. That thing of like, I'm not going to rock the boat. If I step in and anyone's offended by me, then that makes things worse. And it doesn't.
But the boat's already shaking.
Exactly. You're standing up for someone. But I do see it all the time, and everyone just averts their eyes and pretends they're daydreaming. It's almost like they've got, like, they put on their invisible headphones and suddenly they're immune to it. And the irony of it is that that's surely far more impolite not to stand up for someone in need than to go over.
Super weird.
I only had an experience the other day, actually, where I was just, like, coming home from a different job, and two older people, a man and a woman, were walking along, and she was shouting and screaming at him, And she kept saying things like, fuck off, like, get away from me, you dirty bastard, all of this kind of stuff. Which, to me, I very much read as she doesn't want him near her.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, I was like, my first instinct seeing them was they look like a couple. They're similar age. They're walking close together. They've just seemingly come out of a theatre.
Mm-hmm.
But I went over anyway, and I asked if she wanted me to move him along. She said, like, no, and was then all apologetic. Turned out to be a married couple arguing. But, you know, I wasn't going to walk past because I thought, oh, that's going to be on my mind all week.
Yeah.
So there's no harm in me going and checking. Mm-hmm. And I called her mum and I said, do you want me to move this gentleman along? Like, I just automatically went into, like, fancy words to seem more proper. You know what made it all worth it? The baffled look he gave me when I was walking away after she said she was fine, because he'd realised that other people could see this behaviour.
Yeah.
And so whatever had happened that he had probably done to set this off, he was then more accountable for, because a stranger acknowledged it when so many others wouldn't.
Very good.
That's how I'm tying it up into a neat anecdote.
No, good for you. I think that
because it's ambiguous, you know, I didn't know what was happening, but I thought, I'm going to find out.
I think we should never be too embarrassed. That's the worst thing, is people being embarrassed.
Mm.
And that's something that I try never to be. And it's something that's it's a difficulty every day to not embarrass myself, but I'd rather be safe than sorry, and be safe and know that I've done the right thing. I've been in the same situation where a man and women have been fighting and I've been like, do you need help? And she's like, no, he's just a pain. And it's just like drunk people fighting in the street. But I know that I offered, and that was more important than keeping my business to myself.
And that's the thing, if they had needed help, the fact that you actually like stepped out of the default and went and acknowledged it, mm-hmm. then other people would soon enough start crowding around. Because you see it if there's ever paramedics.
Yeah.
For some reason, paramedics arrive and suddenly the whole city centre seems to think it's now their turn. I know that the paramedics are there, that means it's okay.
Yeah.
Maybe you should have gone over before rather than form a crowd now.
Because you've seen an episode of Casualty, so you can probably help.
Yeah. It's an odd one. So it's my understanding that having come from your mum being a comic, you initially stayed away from comedy for a long time.
Yeah.
And then, by the sounds of it, kind of started ticking off other careers that weren't for you and then found yourself back with comedy.
Yeah, I didn't want to be a comedian because it's what everybody said I should do. I like to be against the grain. I don't know. Just what everybody said. Terry Alderton was like, oh, you should be a comedian. And my mum was like, just do comedy. You'd be good at it. You'd be fine. And I was like, no. And I did every other job. I worked in lawyers' offices. I worked in care homes. I worked as a waitress. I worked in every possible imaginable field that is not comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually realised that comedy is probably the only thing I'll be very good at. Not to toot my own horn or my trombone, but comedy, it's just the one place where I feel like I'm doing something good. It's not just for me. I feel like I say things and I make people feel like either they're not alone or they look at me and they go, well, at least their life's not that bad or that weird or we're not that. I just feel like I feel like people come away from me. Some people come away from me. They feel better. And I don't know why and I don't know what it is, but I know that I do it. And it makes me feel better knowing that I've done that when I get like a message on Facebook months after I've done a show saying, oh, I got a smear test because you did a joke about smear tests and they found abnormal cells, but I'm going to be okay. Thank you for making that big joke about smear tests. Or you did a joke about something and I didn't know anybody else had intrusive thoughts or had those kind of thoughts that popped in their head and I thought I was weird, but now I know it's not just me and things like that.
Right. And that's the wonderful disarming nature of comedy, that you can bring up all these topics, but you're doing it in a way that people know how to feel. They don't need to feel uncomfortable or bad for you. They're there to have a laugh.
Yeah.
And then they can reflect on it later because you're still delivering your truth.
Uh-huh.
And a perspective they may not have heard, possibly because no one else in their life is talking about certain things.
Yeah.
And there's great comfort in that.
Yeah, so I feel like a comedy blanket.
Oh, that's nice. Another thing you said in an interview that I really love is you said, to be fair, I always think that comedy is essentially my therapy and you're all just watching it. I love that.
I do feel like that. I'll be stood on stage and I'll think, should I talk about that weird feeling I had? And then I'll go, ah, because we're already pals. We're already so far into this. I'll just say it and I'll see what happens. And then there'll be like a general chuckle over something strange I've said about, like, I did it yesterday. I lost half of my show because I ran out of time because I spoke about the weird dichotomy of masturbation, boys versus girls. How as girls we don't know anything, we don't get told anything, and how when you're like 12 you just find a cushion and cuddle it really tight and it's like, oh. And it just like snowballed and there was people chuckling, but then there was like groups of women spattered throughout the audience who were just like howling with laughter, and I knew, yous know what I'm talking about. Yous have watched Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves and been like, oh, I love Kevin Costner, and cuddled your teddy offy tight, and you know what I'm talking about. And it was nice, it was like a fun feeling because it was like women, older women, like crying with laughter who had probably never really spoke about it. And it just, it was like, it was just a good feeling. And I didn't mind that I'd lost half my show talking nonsense.
Yeah, because you're acknowledging truth.
Yeah.
And that's freeing. And when you feel free, you're more likely to laugh.
Yeah, and it felt good for me as well to just be like, isn't that weird?
Yeah, well, absolutely, because it's a validation for you as well. Like you said, you try and put forward your best self on the stage. And then people laugh and you're like, oh, I'm not completely mental. This is nice.
Yeah.
How reassuring.
Except I don't think I put my best self. I think I literally put all of my scabs and everything out on display. And I'm like, ta-da!
Well, that's even better, because then you're not self-stigmatising by censoring yourself.
I think that if you've seen all of my friend shows, then you probably know everything ever about everything to do with me. Ever. The bad, the good and the ugly. I don't think there's ever been anything I've not spoke about on stage. You're all there. That. All out there on display.
Right, and on that fun note, we'll wrap up there. If people want to learn more about you, where can they find you online?
You can find me at Ashley Story on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And you can listen to my radio show, The Ashley Story Show, on the BBC Sounds app or website.
I love it. And my personal recommendation, if you've ever watched Handmaid's Tale, or even if you haven't, to be quite honest, you did a wonderful sketch of that. If Handmaid's Tale was Scottish, and it's so good.
Thank you.
You're great. And thank you for being part of the interview today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.